Can you hear me now? Okay, Oz will be an hour-ish in that sort of order, and then he'll want to have a time of fairly extended questions after that. So you can write down your questions as you go, and then you can raise those with him in sort of session here. I'd like us to pray before I ask Oz to come forward. Lord, we thank you that you have laid your hand upon people to minister to us through the spoken word. We thank you for the written word too, that Oz is able to use. And we pray that you'll bless his ministry to us this afternoon. We pray that the things that are spoken will awaken new ideas and new possibilities for us, that the ultimate result will be glorification of your name. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here again and continue, and to see some of you who weren't here yesterday. So many came up actually and said that they couldn't be here on Sunday and they wouldn't get the tapes. I wonder if any left. So it's good to see a good number anyway this afternoon. I don't know if it's your experience, but it's certainly mine, that Christian circles in England often think in different parts of the world in different categories. For instance, a place like West Irian Jaya, probably through books like Peace Child, Thanks to Reader's Digest and so on, they think of in terms of missionary categories. Whereas a country like America, they think of in terms of political categories. And they don't actually bring the same sort of thoughts to bear on each. So you get a lot of Christians in England who are deeply stirred by the movement of God or the movement of the Spirit in this country and that country, usually, quote, the mission field, but would never think of discussing America in any of those sort of terms, and just come out with descriptions and categories and judgments which are much the same as any other reader of the local newspaper. Now, I want to do deliberately a rather odd thing this afternoon, which I didn't plan to do last night, I would have warned you, and that is, in this response, look particularly at the issues that we were talking about yesterday in terms of America, for a certain reason. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, let me put it like this. What we're looking at is the challenge of what's known as the gravedigger thesis. This comes from the social sciences and points out that Christianity contributed to the rise of the modern world, in the 18th century and so on, committed itself uncritically to the world that it helped create, and was slowly, and has slowly in 200 years, been undermined by that world, and is becoming, in effect, its own gravedigger. So if you look at the church in the last 200 years, modernization has done more damage than any foe in Christian history. Now, we were looking at the challenge in the two sessions yesterday, and these other three have something by way of a response to that. But the reason I want to look at America now is this. If you understand this, you can see that it's no good in this situation looking to the third world and saying, isn't it extraordinary what's happening? For instance, many people point out the growth of the church in Asia, or the tremendous development of the gospel, sub-Sahara Africa. Fantastic things are happening in Latin America and Africa and Asia. But we dare not misuse this, which is a genuine growth, for this reason, that these parts of the world are as yet unmodernized. In other words, we can thank God for the life they have, which often we don't have. But they will have to look what's happened to us, so that with their life and our lessons, as it were, we can see something of their renewal, but they can learn from some of our mistakes. If the church is to be modernized in the third world without being shaped the way we have been, and if we're to be renewed in the first world, although we've been as shaped as we have been to this point. Now, it's interesting that in this situation, you don't, by and large, and I'm speaking humanly now, God may have his own purposes which surprise us all so often. Humanly speaking, you don't look to countries that were once strong. For instance, among the countries which has been tremendously strong in sending out the word and the spirit in the past has been my own country, Britain. But it's really down at the very low point in spiritual terms and statistical terms and all sorts of ways. Humanly speaking, one can see that the two most, humanly speaking, I keep underlining, strategic parts of the world are the third world and North America. So I'd like to take America for a double reason. Well, for several reasons. But one is, it is in the modern world the country where, humanly speaking, the gospel has the greatest opportunity. So what happens in America, humanly speaking, is of enormous strategic spiritual significance. The second reason I'd like to take America is that so often we who are non-Americans, British and I know Australians, because some of you have done it in the last couple of days, we find it very easy to knock America and not to consider it in terms of its spiritual strategy. The third reason I would say is the sort of approach here I'm giving to America is what I would challenge you to do to Australia. In other words, to see if you can see a strategic overview of what's happening in Australia so that you can make sense of your own times, as it says in 2 Chronicles 12, so that your own faithfulness and obedience as Christian disciples is rooted in an understanding of where Australia is, so that you're speaking out imaginatively and significantly right into the scene. Okay? So at first, this may look extremely odd. Why am I an Englishman to you Australians talking about America? But I'm sure you've done that many times with other parts of the world in, quote, missionary situations. Well, think of it in that terms or any of these others. Because I think you can see that America is of extraordinary strategic significance for the gospel, humanly speaking, so that we need to understand, certainly, and pray also. Now, in the next session, we'll go on and we'll take up a very different response altogether. So this is different from last night. Let me start like this. Just before he died, Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of State in America, was talking to a European diplomat, and he made the remark, "The awesome challenge of being an American statesman is how, in an atomic age, to steer a world power that is saddled with a constitution of an 18th century farmer's republic." In other words, he said, how can America today live in line with America of its past? And in few modern countries is the past so reasoned, so clear, and so critical. And the interesting thing about America in the 80s is the 80s is raising questions which are calling that question into question once again in ways that some people could see as decisive. And two particular issues are being raised, underlying many others, and you'll see that in America, in ways they wouldn't be in England or Australia, the gospel is critical and in relation to these issues. The first issue is this. What is Americanism? What is Americanism? You took 100 Americans in a room and asked them, what's America? You get 100 different answers at first. But after a while, if you dig deep and ask further, you get down to certain shared values, and actually you get down right at the heart to actually common views of America, many of which are rooted in things like the flag, deeper still in freedom, and deepest of all in things like faith. And yet that's one of the issues at the stake in the 80s. What is Americanism? The second issue is, can America any longer claim to be exceptional? So-called claim to exceptionalism. It's often been said that America's exceptional, not just because she's more rich or whatever, but because she has certain values which prevent ideological class divides and extreme political movements and so on, and therefore she's never been hassled by these things which many of the other nations in Europe or out of a European background like Australia are being hassled by. America hasn't suffered from these things, and yet now that claim to exceptionalism is being undermined. Now what I want to look at is America in the 80s in the light of these issues and show you the relevance of the gospel to them. First of all, let's look at the whole context of this crisis. Secondly, look at the contribution of the gospel at the present moment. And thirdly, look at the whole challenge of the relationship between faith and society for the future in America. And as you'll see, it's not just an American issue. For the simple fact, America is number one in the world, willy-nilly, whether we like it or not, for better or worse, America is the world's lead society, and the Christian community is one of the strongest minority group in America. What America does and what the church does in America is extraordinarily important for the world and for the gospel at this moment. So look at it in these terms rather than it being something odd, as I keep stressing. All right, let's first start by looking at the context of this present crisis. If you were to ask what are the forces that have shaped the crisis that many Americans feel, for instance, more than 50 books have come out recently saying America's at a turning point, or a structural transformation, or a restructuring, more than 50 books. Many people see it as this sort of turning point. Now, if you analyze all the forces, you could boil them down rather simply to two basic things underlying all others, and the interplay between them. The first is the more obvious, but the shorter term, and the far more easily reversed, and that is the economic crisis. It's in your papers, it's in our papers, it's in their papers, common to many of our countries. Extraordinary inflation, drop in productivity, etc., etc., etc. One hardly needs to say any more about that. The second, though, is much more interesting. That is much less obvious. Much longer term has been going on for 25, 30 years and longer, and is far less easily reversed, even if we wanted to. And that is that America is seeing what other countries are seeing in lesser ways, but America in more extreme ways, a process of broad social diffusion or centralization. I'll give you some examples. The early 60s, for the first time, America developed nationwide media. And we take these things for granted now, late 70s, early 80s, and so on. But no sooner have we reached this period of sort of nationwide media and press and so on, then it is already beginning to break up and be decentralized through the microchip and all the new media revolution, the home computers, etc. So a huge process of each person in his own electronic cottage watching his or her programs and so on. And you can see the threat to this, to the old monopoly media. But media is only one play. Take, say, politics. In the old days in America, there used to be Republican loyalties, Democratic loyalties, but now the old party loyalties are breaking up, and you have the rise of single-issue politics, and a highly fluid, volatile situation where the electorate can't be counted on any longer, the old loyalties. So you have not only single-issue politics, but political action committees rising up like mushrooms to deal with this issue, that issue, get this money for that task, and then fading away equally fast. A highly decentralized, diffused, looser sort of view in politics. Or take religion. The old days of the massive, mainline, clearly defined denominations, I am this or I am that, are gone. And now people are hanging loose in the denominational loyalties, and many have none at all. And of course you see the shift from the denominations, not even that, to the house, to the local churches, to the home churches, many of which are tied in with nothing, and many don't even go to any groups at all in America. They just have their faith as they watch the box in their own home by themselves, the church of the tube. Now these are just simple examples of the process of decentralization. You could take other issues, say the family, the crisis of the extended family to the nuclear family, the rising divorce rate, and so on and so on. What you see is massive movement of social decentralization. Now, put those two together, economic crisis, social diffusion. And you can easily see how over the last 30 years, those have been like sort of shock waves working out on America. Let's go back to the 50s. Some of us here are old enough to remember the 50s. 50s often today is a sort of quarry for the nostalgia industry. But the 50s are key in America for this reason. It was the last decade when Americanism was intact. There was an innocence. Any of you ever seen Oklahoma, the musical? You know, watch it in the 80s, and it is almost sort of... was there really a world like that so recently? It's extraordinary to watch it. The innocence and sort of charm of some of that period compared to what's happening since, it's just quite extraordinary. But there was an innocence and intactness. Now, if you analyze that, there were three things at its root or its foundation. First, there was a sense of social stability. From families up to government, American institutions were strong and they inspired confidence. Secondly, there was a sense of moral legitimacy. In other words, these things were not only there, they were right and good and proper. And many of them would have justified them by Christian principles. Thirdly, there was a strong sense of economic prosperity. Certainly by comparison with the 30s and the Depression years through the acceleration of the economic machine in World War II. In other words, you had those three things there unquestioned. Social stability, moral legitimacy, economic prosperity. But move on from the 50s. And of course, remember in the 50s, America taking over from the tired, war-weary Europe as the new leader of the world, having defeated Hitler, now taking on the implacable foe of communism and so on, and the tremendous confidence and sense of power that the Americans had at that stage. Move on to the 60s. In this sense, the 60s was important because it rocked the first two decisively. Social stability. From families up through schools, through law courts, through the army, right up to the state, a profound challenge to all these long-accepted institutions of the American life. But that was not only true of the institutions, it was also true of the beliefs which underlay them. In other words, the social stability was rocked, but so also was the moral legitimacy. Families were bourgeois. Police were, quote, pigs. America was spelt with a K in a fascist overtone, and after all, God was dead. So you could see right across the board a profound challenging of the viability of the old institutions, but also a profound challenge for all the values and beliefs and principles and so on that underlay them in all sorts of ways. Some of the old ones were outmoded, such as families. Who needed families in the day of alternative living arrangements and so on? But some of the new ones were now considered threatening. For instance, the universities became multiversities and they processed students like IBM cards. Or the army was no longer the military and a point of patriotism and pride. It became, even in the president's words, the military-industrial complex. Something now that has a strange Lovian atmosphere to it and has almost ever since. But, you notice in the 60s, the third part was not shaken. And that's very important. Economic prosperity went from strength to strength. So much so that two things happened. First, unrealistic expectations were set. In other words, that sense of growth from bigger to better and so on is still with us, and many people are living with inflated expectations that the 60s raised and the 70s and later decades may never be able to satisfy. And yet that standard was set. But secondly, and equally importantly, the 60s created a freedom to experiment which was also unrealistic. For instance, in the 60s, youth was created. Now, there were young people before that, don't misunderstand me. But youth in the sense of a particular generation, a particular market that could choose its own clothes and its own records and its own lifestyles and so on as a whole prosperous new enclave, that was new to the late 50s and early 60s. Although many of the so-called youth lived off their parents, what they saw was the freedom to experiment with the new sexual arrangements, into drugs or whatever. They didn't realize that often they were living off their parents and their lifestyles and their philosophies were undercutting the branch on which they were sitting because they had the economic prosperity and the lack of realism was not perceived at the time. So the 60s, if the 50s was a decade of traditionalism, The 60s was the decade of the counterculture, against tradition at almost every point. In religious areas, it was increasingly secularizing. God is dead at the extreme, but many extreme theological movements that were in the same direction. In the political areas, it was sort of liberal to radical. But the general direction of the 60s, in much of the world, but certainly in America, was non-traditional. It was called the decade of the counterculture, or the movement decade. On to the 70s. In the 70s, many other things have happened, but in terms of this, the key thing is that the third part of those foundations has been shaken. Incidentally, the social decentralization has gone much further still. You can see it, for instance, in a simple thing like violence. Traditional violence, say traditional murder, if we could use such a horrible term, traditionally murder was of people you know. Most murders were of within families or between friends. They were of people you know. It's a feature of the strung-out, ruthless, anonymous society of the late 70s that murder is increasingly of strangers. Muggings. Or sort of celebrity seekers who want to shoot the president and achieve identity and so on. And all of this is the expression of the increasing ruthlessness and decentralization going apace. But while that's all true, and you could also analyze the way the 60s ideals failed, the interesting thing to notice is the third foundation was shaken. In other words, the economic prosperity stalled. American productivity, believe it or not, is barely higher than the British. You know what that means. American mobility has been overtaken by most European nations. The American standard of living has been overtaken by five European nations. So in 1969, all the American indicators were in the lead for the whole world. Now, they're lagging at many, many, many points, which not only changes the whole lifestyle and expectations, more importantly, they know, for many areas now, there are no economic solutions. There are no technological solutions. The sense that the economy is a powerful motor that can smash through any barrier has gone, and that's quite different. So the 70s, which began as the counterculture collapsed, first began as a turning from the institutional forms of protest to much more individualistic types of concern, the me decade. Incredibly narcissistic and selfish. But then as the 70s went on, that sense of untroubled preoccupation with the self began to be troubled. In other words, they realized the consequences of the failures of the 60s and so on, and you began to get a very uncertain conservatism replacing the unanxious narcissism of the early period. And so you can see the end of the 70s in America, all the troubled, uptight people saying this, that, and the other about the American problem, out of which many political movements were spawned. Now you see all that's the context of our crisis. So do you see how first Americanism is at stake? What's the American way of life when no one has a Protestant work ethic left, virtually? What's the American way of life in terms of the family when the American family is lauded in public and is completely shot in statistics on the ground? And the personal psychological anguish is mounting all the time. What is the American melting pot when many of the so-called ethnic minorities are now considered unmeltable? What is the American creed and belief in patriotism when even the bicentennial didn't inspire confidence again post-Vietnam? You see, at point after point, many of the things that underlay Americanism have been undermined. And people are realizing it. Equally, America can no longer claim to be that exceptional. And the whole claim to exceptionalism has been undermined. And if you can look at it, you can see the uneasy tension in much of America between the conservatives who'd like to go back and the liberals who'd like to go forward. And you can see a fault line running between down American society between the two. Anyway, let's move on from the context to the contribution of the Christian community at this point. Now, you could start like this. If we were to ask, what was one of the deepest roots of Americanism? Or if we were to ask, is there any exception to the decline of America as it being exceptional? The answer is the same to both questions. The answer in America is religion, specifically the Christian faith. You could put it one of two ways. America has made one of the sharpest separations of church and state in the modern world of any country coming out of the European background. And yet, America has the closest relationship of faith and society of any country in the modern world. Or you can put it another way. in the modern world, in almost all instances, the more modernized the world, the less religious the country. That's true in England, in France, in Sweden, in Australia, and so on. But America is both the most modern country and the most religious of modern countries, completely out of step with all the others. Extraordinarily exceptional. Or you could put it another way. In almost all countries in the world, the higher the standard of education, formally, the lower the level of affiliation spiritually. America is quite out of step, having the highest standards of formal education and the highest levels of officially attested belief. Do you know that America has spiritual affiliation, however you measure it, in beliefs or churchgoing or whatever, on a par with the most illiterate Asian or African nations? And yet it's the most educated country. In other words, at point after point, America is strikingly exceptional in terms of what is happening in the modern world. And this, of course, runs counter to much of the experience in Europe. It runs counter to what many of their own academics would like to be so. And it runs counter to what many of their media portray. You don't see many of JR's relatives being Christians, to put it mildly, in Dallas, or any of their great worldwide seen soap operas. The academic world and the media being related to the academic world have assumptions which are much closer to the European experience and model, and frankly they neither expect nor even perceive in some instances that many of their own contemporaries are some of the most religious people on earth, and they have never seen it. So something extraordinary is happening in America compared with all the other modernized countries in the world. We've got to start by saying that. On the one hand, America is strikingly exceptional. On the other hand, got to follow it up by saying, she also shows the deep underlying contradictions in terms of the faith in that society. What do I mean by that? Well, we don't go too deep into it, but let me just do one hand on the other hand, remembering Roosevelt's hatred of two-handed economists and so on. On the one hand, you can see the enormous social and spiritual vitality of the American Christian community. What do I mean by spiritual vitality? Well, you know what I mean by that. I mean there's genuine renewal of the Holy Spirit. What do I mean by social vitality of the gospel? Well, let me give you an Australian example to show you what I mean in America. A few years back in Melbourne, I think it was, the bishop of the Ukrainian Catholics pointed out to his own people that every time there was persecution in the Ukraine, there was revival in Melbourne. Persecution in the Ukraine, revival in Melbourne. Now, how do you explain that? The Ukrainian Catholics had left the Ukraine to come for freedom to Australia. As they got more prosperous and they moved up the ladder in Australian life and dreams, slowly they'd melted into Melbourne society and lost their distinctiveness as Ukrainian Catholics. But then when there was persecution by the Russians in the Ukraine, they felt culturally threatened in terms of their identity. And which was the guardian, the carrier, the cultural sort of center of their identity in Australia? The Ukrainian Catholic Church. So there was, quote, revival, but their own bishop was quick to say it was for social rather than spiritual reasons. Do you see it? Now, in America, the gospel has both spiritual and social vitality. For instance, the immigrant groups. Or, you can think of the way, just the simple historical fact, that many of the people who founded North America went there to find freedom from the repressive state churches in England, France, etc., etc. So from the very beginning, if you went to France, to be free was to be against faith. And the French said you wanted to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. So faith and freedom went in two different directions. But in America, by contrast, faith and freedom have always gone hand in hand, because they went to America to find freedom to have faith. So there has never been the negative connotation, the negative resonance which you have in Australia because of the convict beginnings or whatever, in England because of the state church background. America has always had a resonance between faith and freedom historically, which gives it both spiritual and social vitality. You see it? So on the one hand, enormous spiritual and social vitality. On the other hand, deep underlying weaknesses. In the light of where we started yesterday, let me just mention two and you'll see how they fit in. First, despite the strains, for instance, in parts of the Midwest, the church going is 75% of the community. I don't just mean in one village of 300 people. I mean huge areas of the Midwest. Church going is 75% of the population. But the point I was making yesterday is this. Secularization and modernization hasn't undercut the statistics in America, but it's undercut the shape of faith and its significance in America. I would put it very simply. There have never been more Christians than there are today in America. They have never had so much money as they have today. They have never had such organs of communication and power. They have never had such positions of influence. All those things can be shown and substantiated. But rarely has the spiritual life made so little social impact as it does today. One in three is claiming to be born again, but American life goes on roughly regardless. Or, to be more distinct, you can see two things very clearly because of modernization in America. First, the gospel is unusually diluted. Think of what we've talked yesterday. McDonald's hamburgers, the one I used. I believe in God, the family, McDonald's hamburgers, and when I go to the office, I reverse the order. So faith becomes privately engaging, socially relevant. So those 75% people in the Midwest say that Jesus is Lord, their orthodoxy of doctrine is impeccable, but their praxis, their orthopraxy, as it were, is absolutely shot through and neutralized, and they have not even realized it. So despite their numbers, and despite their orthodoxy, and despite their renewal, there is an extraordinary dilution of the faith. Did you know that church going drops off as you go west in America? The faith doesn't. Church going does. Why? At first people thought, well, maybe you go further west, maybe the scientific worldview is eaten in more, people are more secular. Far from it. They're equally religious, equally Christian, they just don't bother to go to church. Why? Cars and mobility and various things like that increase as you go west, and you get a much more hang-loose attitude to faith. And point after point after point, you can see the weakness of genuine Christian truth and discipleship at all sorts of places. So you can get extraordinary statistics, but many of them need to be heavily discounted. For instance, I can't remember statistics offhand, but it's an extraordinary number, above 80%, who believe in the significance, the absolute significance of the Ten Commandments. But of that number, only a tiny minority can tell you what more than four of them are. You know, and this is the sort of dilution of faith that you have in practice in 100 different ways in the American situation. But that isn't the end of the story. You not only have an unusual dilution, you have a unique distortion of the gospel in America. Being diluted in such a powerful culture, often the church gets squeezed into the mold of the culture. So you have something that's powerfully religious, ostensibly Christian, but is actually profoundly worldly. I gave you the example yesterday of the prosperity doctrines. What I would describe as consumer religion, the marriage of dollar and doctrine, producing something which is really the money changers in modern disguise, but in the name of the disciples of Christ, rather than those who are the opponents of Christ. And if you analyze America, the structures of its capitalist society, for instance, the media. I'll just give you one example, the media. If you look at the world's media, there are various types. It's a totalitarian, like the Russian. The sort of more paternal approach, like the BBC. Or the commercial, like ITV in our country, most of the American system. On the surface, the commercial system looks the most free, doesn't it? After all, you can say anything if you can pay for it. Wait a minute. You can say anything if you can afford to pay for it and say it profitably. Which means that commercial television, and the bottom line is for profit, spelled F-I-T-S, not spelled P-H-E-T-S. Now, when you put Christian television in that context, you see that it's booming, but not in terms of the full counsel of God or the scandal of the cross or the demands of discipleship, but in terms of the prosperity doctrines and so on and so on and so on. So what you see is consumer religion is the Christian faith shaped by capitalist structure. Now, notice and don't misunderstand me, I personally am not against capitalism. I personally would say that many of those who are supporting socialism in our world are rather uncritical about it. And the even more extremes are abominable, I think, having lived under one of the world's worst myself. So I'm not a critic of capitalism. I myself would like to bound it and put principles around it, and I think it's a good deal better than some of the others. But when capitalism shapes the gospel, that is profoundly evil for the gospel. And yet consumer religion in America is where culture is shaping the faith rather than the other way around. You can see other examples. But you see, because of that, it means that the gospel is both unusually diluted and unusually distorted. And so although they had this extraordinary numbers and power and significance and opportunity and so on, the impact is not there. And it simply all goes together to raise the question, with America being what she is at this particular moment in the world, does the church have the capacity to respond to the challenge of the hour? Now, you may have to attack what you think is Americans at some point, but you also, at the same time, ought profoundly to be moved to pray, if that's the question. Let's move on, thirdly, from the whole context of this, to the contribution of the gospel, to the challenge and consequences of this in the next couple of generations. I don't know another modern country in the Western world, you could take Poland and the Eastern world, I don't know another country in the modern Western world where religion is really one of the basic ingredients in futurology. For instance, I've taken part in studies at Oxford on the future of this country or that country and so on. And you, of course, consider religion in Iran or Saudi Arabia or Poland. But among the first world countries, properly called, which other country is religion a genuine component in the questions of where the country is going in the future? Certainly not in Australia, and certainly not in Britain, to take our two. But in America it is. Both at the tiny level of certain issues, for instance the peace movement in America, the religious component is very, very important. But let's just take the much wider picture. Because most people, looking at the whole question of where America goes, realize that religion has an absolutely crucial place. And since Christianity is the most strong community of the religious ones in America, that means, in essence, that the church has a crucial place. So let me just show you here the four scenarios about how people see things are going. You'll notice in each of these that either the presence or the absence of the Christian faith works out one way or another in the next 20, 30, 50 years. Here's scenario one. These are sort of possible outcomes. Scenario one is of a liberal, secular American tomorrow. As this scenario sees it, society will pick up again in terms of the economy. So people will not be hassled by many of the recent problems of the 70s. The impact of modernization will be such that what Christian faith is left, there'll be millions of Christians, but they'll all have a faith that's privately engaging, socially relevant, so they'll do their own thing in their own small corner under their own small palm tree, and no longer will they bring out their faith in any publicly decisive way into American society. So you will have a broadly secular canopy, or a sort of global umbrella over American culture, which is broadly secular, but highly liberal in the sense that everything goes, everything is tolerated, everything's permissive, including the religious if you want it. But no longer will religion make any decisive social influence in that society. Now, you can see certain problems within this scenario itself. For instance, in the past, in American life, there's been a strong tension between the Enlightenment principles and Christian principles. And often it's been Christian principles which put a brake on the individualism inherent in much Americanism. But if the faith became irrelevant, then there would be no break. In the 70s shows you the type of narcissism towards which people are leading today. If that had no break or bounds on it, it would be chaotic. Someone said to me, what happened if all Americans began to behave in economics or in environment so on, like sort of John McEnroe's? Because what you're seeing in a kind of John McEnroe on the court is a kind of athletic Darwinism. But say you saw that in area after area after area in America, you'd actually see something profoundly self-defeating. Because when America deals with the big issues such as the environment or the nuclear issue or third world aid, if that form of sort of Darwinism in economic terms or psychological terms or whatever was to work out in family structures or international relations, it would be profoundly self-defeating. So I think many non-Christian thinkers can see the writing on the wall for America if that was to come. Which is why even some non-Christians see one of the other next two scenarios. Scenario two is a crisis and decline. Thinkers who see this, in other words, would see that slowly the moral basis to the social order is being undermined. The moral basis to the social order is being undermined. as this happens, America, which has so uniquely relied on a sort of spiritual basis to so many things, will be uniquely affected. A long time ago, Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out that France was so authoritarian, pre-revolutionary France, that she didn't need any faith. Russia doesn't today. When you're totalitarian, authoritarian, you don't need faith or principles. You just say, this is it, boys, and lay it down. In other words, de Tocqueville pointed out, the more free a country is, the more it is in need of faith, because its very freedom becomes destructive unless it has a subtle bonding of faith. I interviewed Kissinger about 4 years ago for the BBC. And he said in the course of a fascinating interview, I see America falling into, quote, a spiritual void. And he said, I argue with many of the young radicals, and they don't realize they're undercutting the basis of traditional American life in their enthusiastic zeal. They're undercutting the spiritual and moral basis to the social order. My professor, when I went to Oxford, pointed out that Western societies have less spiritual basis to their moral orders, less spiritual and moral basis to their social orders, than any previous societies in history. He actually believes that it soon will be only a thin web of technology which holds us together. Things ranging from traffic lights up to computer banking. Without that, our moral values wouldn't be enough to hold Western society together. So free and so unprincipled are we becoming. Well, that's the second scenario. Some people do see crisis and decline. I don't mean in 5 years. I mean over the next 50 years at some point is what they see it. The third scenario is those who see, in a couple of words, the scenario is one of traditional authoritarianism. In other words, this scenario is of those who see that at some point someone will try and halt the crisis by imposing values, not because they're true, but because they're useful. In other words, traditional values to hold the ship together when she's foundering. Now, of course, that hasn't been done in the past very often. If you look around American society, which type of religion are they going to use? Well, they're not going to look to TM. The media may play up TM, but statistics show that at most there are 3 to 5 million practicing TM. Well, that's minuscule in America, in a nation over 200 million. Quite irrelevant. TM is not going to be the social glue that holds America together. Are they going to look to liberal theology? Well, leave theology aside. They're not going to look to liberal theology, and I've actually heard them discussing this. They won't look to liberal theology for two simple practical reasons. One is it doesn't appeal to grassroots people. Two is it changes so fast. Which liberal theology would you use? But don't smile. Which faith will they use as glue? Conservative Christianity. Or let's be more blunt, which faith have they used and are they now using? In other words, there are certain secular politicians who would like to see religion encouraged so that it may be used and exploited. Again, in a particular documentary I made, I was interviewing people who thought automatically I was English and from the BBC, I must be an atheist. You know, automatic equation. And so they spoke to me candidly about these crazy lunatics who believe things, you know, and so on. As a value-free reporter, I had to listen to it and so on, and often only afterwards did I tell them where I stood. Anyway, I can think of one person who described how 5 years, well-known person to Americans, he and a few others had strategically planned to woo and win the preachers and evangelists on the fundamentalist side because they recognized back in the mid-70s they were the key to extreme right-wing conservative politics. So, for instance, they said, these Christians are privatized, as we were looking at yesterday. So they will be turned on through hot-button issues. Hot-button issues being things like abortion and so on, which are all in the private area, which you can spur people on to really take care of, and then we can get them in to support our right-wing economic issues and so on. A deliberate, carefully, coldly calculated manipulation which has actually been going on for quite a while. Now, there's the third scenario. Traditional authoritarianism. Christianity used not because it's true, but because it's useful for holding society together. The last scenario. Genuine revitalization renewal. of all the spiritual, of all the social institutions in America through real renewal and reformation. Now, immediately our hearts warm to such a thing. Renewal and genuine reformation on whatever model we take, going right the way back through our Christian tradition. But having said that, don't you see that that's the hardest of the four? Precisely because of modernization, you already have the numbers, you have the orthodoxy in so many areas, but you still do not have the practice of the Lordship of Christ breaking the bounds of modernity in all these areas as we were looking at yesterday. So many Christians in America would hear that and their hearts would respond, and hopefully all Christians around the world would. Because it's the interest of the gospel at stake, and yet that's the hardest of all of them to actually see working out in practice, unless some of the things we were talking about yesterday can be really done in practical terms and can make an impact on American society. So as you look at America in the 80s, it's an extraordinary situation. America is the world's lead society. You don't have to say she's good, or you back her, or believe in her, or whatever, to say that. Willy-nilly, just as Britain 150 years ago was the world's lead society in the first Industrial Revolution, America is the world's lead society in the second Industrial Revolution. No argument about it. But having said that, how significant it is that just as in Britain 150 years ago, evangelical Christians came to the fore at that precise moment, but failed after 30 years. Many Christians are coming to the fore in America at this same moment. And the question is, what will they do? So at this extraordinary decade, what America does as the world's number one society is absolutely crucial. Surely it's no accident that at such a time as this, the Christian community, which has been in many ways in the cultural closet and backwater for so long, has now emerged from the closet, and with all its confusions and dangers and so on, is now out there center stage. And this is why, with all my heart, I believe this is kind of an American hour in the biblical sense of kairos, a moment which before God is ripe to be seized by people of faith and obedience and really spoken into and acted into for Christ's sake. What happens, who knows? My sadness looking at America is that so few of them seem to realize the strategic significance of where they are in world terms or in terms of the gospel in America, in the world. And that's the first reason, as I said, I share it with you. It's only too easy for us as English or Australians to knock Americans. And several of you did it yesterday afternoon. I hope you didn't think I was doing that. I was just using their examples that were fatuous and extreme to show us tens. But in many ways, while we should learn from their extreme mistakes, as we were looking at yesterday, we should be those deeply concerned to pray for the cause of the gospel in America, as we would in West Irangia or wherever you think of in terms of missionary or spiritual situations. Because this is an extraordinary moment. But the second challenge, and here I can't help you, is for you to go on and to take such a model and to say, where are the signs of the times in Australia? Now, I'm not saying Australia is facing the same hour. Far from it. Australia is very different. America was founded in the 17th century, so people went there for faith in the name of freedom. You were founded in the 18th century under very different circumstances, in a very different philosophical and cultural climate. And all sorts of things are different. In America, the land with its extraordinary openness has always been the promised land. Whereas here, the very different nature of your environment has been a very different attitude to your land. You can think how Australians have different aspirations, different styles, your humour enshrined in various ways, your whole, say, the difference between a redneck and an ocker, and many, many things like this. There are hundred differences in the cultural and spiritual ways. But I would just challenge you, not just to be a Christian where you are, unthinkingly, and not just, which we must certainly do, to understand our Christian heritage right back through the pages of history, right back to the scriptures and on beyond that to the people of God in the Old Testament, and to having a living awareness that we're part of the people of God and a living community down through the ages, but also to add to that the dimension that you are Christians in a particular land at a particular time, and much of your faithfulness and obedience will come because you can skilled in making sense of your times to know what course you as the Israel of God here in Australia should follow. So, let's all pray for American Christians and for the stake of the gospel in America. But let's equally wrestle with our own countries and cultures and contexts to see what God is saying, what God is doing, where things are, that we may speak faithfully. Because the danger is that since we're not in that situation, we fall into the trap of the 70s, early 80s, which is basically a kind of cultural narcissism. You remember Narcissus? He drowned. Modern culture puts such a stress on know yourself in 100 ways, from psychology to what you don't eat because of the dreadful things that might be in it. I've heard enough of that in 2 days here. Yeah. You know, in other words, the narcissistic problems are all around us. But you remember, Narcissus, in his attempt to know himself, reflected so much on himself, he fell in the lake and drowned. Even the Greeks didn't make that mistake. If you went to Delphi, over the temple at Delphi were four words. On one side, know yourself. And on the other side, know your moment. Now actually, know yourself is not a biblical ideal at all. But know your moment is. In other words, there is a moment under God. Because time is not cyclical, nor is it linear in just a flat way. There's a sense that God works into history, and those who perceive the way God works in particular cultures and time, obedience becomes the key to history rather than power or movements, because people with obedience seize the moment under God with faithfulness and enterprise, and so they're able to affect history. Now, I've heard a lot of people here talking about Australianness 8 years later in a way I didn't in 75. Simply because Australians are, with these television ads and all that sort of thing, you know, there's much greater sense of Australianness, which no doubt would be encouraged if you win the America's Cup and various other things, which I hope you don't. Having said that, don't just, and this is where some Christians have made the mistake, uncritically reflect the search for Australianness. Make sure you're as critical as that as you were of the sort of whatever was there before, so that you really understand what obedience to Christ in Australia in the 80s means for you. So it's an odd way round, perhaps, but I trust you see what I'm challenging you to do. Let's leave it again, and as we yesterday, let's have 60 seconds to stretch our legs, particularly after Sunday lunch, and then we'll come back for a time of discussion. He has been defined as the art of talking in someone else's sleep. Certainly, Arthur, a good Sunday lunch is not the best time to think too seriously. But done very well. Let's have a time of discussion, just as long as we'll break at 3 at the latest, and then have a break before the next session. Anyone like... Yes? Rearmament or majority? I wouldn't put them in that sort of mould. You know, moral rearmament began in Oxford among people who originally were evangelical Christians. And the danger, I don't think, is that they get exploited so much for the status quo, is that, from a Christian perspective, is that they've lost their distinctively Christian basis and principles. So that although the early ones, and many of the later ones, I have friends with moral rearmament who are fine and distinctive Christians now. You know, many of them out at the headquarters, for instance, in Co, are Hindus and all sorts of things, and any distinctively Christian contribution to it is lost, and the four absolutes are so vague and generalized, and apart from the teaching of Scripture, that they actually undermine some of our Christian doctrines. So that, for instance, I know some of those who are Christians, and even evangelicals, or call themselves evangelicals, who would deny, say, the atonement and the importance of the work of Christ on the cross because of the way they have elevated and distorted the four absolutes. But I think that's the sort of mistake they tend to make, the distortion of Christian truth, or dilution in some ways, rather than the other. Because they do, in some countries of the world, fight very courageously for justice, as they've done in Latin America and parts of Africa, and so on. Now, what I said would apply more to moral majority. as a temptation, even more so to some of the extreme. For instance, the group called Christian Voice in America, which put out in the 1980 elections what was called a morality index. And what it was a sheet of paper showing you the names of all the senators and all the congressmen and how they'd voted on umpteen issues and how you could tell whether they were moral and therefore whether you vote for them as Christians. But it's a good example of what I was saying, because the issues were not really Christian, they were just right-wing. So they said so-and-so was moral and Christian, therefore vote for him, whereas actually they didn't say the issues picked were right-wing. So you had extraordinary anomalies. Mark Hatfield, whom has been described by one of the extreme conservatives on the right as the most moral man in the Senate. You know, he's the man in favor of the priest movement and so on. He's the man who's a profound Christian, and yet Christians write to him, dear former brother in Christ, because they just disagree with his principles. He scored a miserable 23% in this rating. Whereas a man who was indicted later in the Abscam scandal and was an absolute rogue scored 100%. Well, Hatfield was, well, no, light and day in terms of morals and character, but Hatfield, of course, did not rate in terms of Taiwan and certain things in schools and certain things in the Panama and so on. In other words, they confused Christian principles and conservative politics unwittingly in this case, and therefore were ripe for manipulation. And that's more the sort of danger I was meaning. Yeah.
I want to check if I heard what you're saying. Does it seem right to you to treat as positive some things in the society and treat others as negative from a Christian point of view? Or is it that we stand against our society totally?
Oh, no. Some things are magnificently positive.
That's what I thought you'd say. Mm.
No, in other words, we resist all that which is evil or corrupt or whatever, as judged by Christian truth, which means it will be less human, etc. But all that which is positive, we affirm and are glad to. And this should be so even, say, in our communication. You can communicate one of two ways, either fastening on the half-lie in a person's position, pushing it out to be true to it, knowing they can't be, which is the negative way, or you can fasten on the fact they're holding the truth in unrighteousness, as Paul says in Romans, therefore you're half fastening on the half-truth, the positive thing, and pushing them to see that actually they're onto the right thing, but it points way beyond what they see. You know, there's always that double approach to our culture or in communication or whatever. Yes?
I've always thought that it's rather a waste of time to try and hoist our Christian morality onto a society that is very much post-Christian, like here in Australia, for instance. Do you think that's a fair way to look at it? We should be rather reaching out with the gospel and not trying to preach morality, which again, something like Christian of life. They are sort of pushing a moral point of view all the time, which is right. You know, their moral standards are Christian, and they've got the very best intentions. And do you think that is really a waste of time, you know, pushing that on the people when the people in our society completely rejected Christian morality?
Mm-hmm.
Rather be preaching the gospel.
The two issues, one of foisting, and then the other, the complete rejecting. See, the second isn't true about America, but let's take the foisting. I thoroughly agree with you on the foisting. The funny thing is, it's the very people who 20 years ago would have said the social gospel's wrong, you've got to win a person to Christ before you whatever, are now doing exactly the same thing. They're using legislation publicly as a substitute for morality before ever trying to win them. And they are foisting it or imposing it in many ways out of the panic reaction of impotence and uptightness. You know, that's happened in a part of America, and I have heard it among certain Australian Festival of Light people, as we have it in England. Not that many of their stances are wrong, but some of it has an uptightness, which is more a matter of cultural defensiveness or psychological defensiveness than it has any defensiveness properly understood of the gospel. Now, I think we've got to go out with courage and argue the Christian truths, win people to Christ, and so on. But it's as they come to faith, which is obedience to truth in the Pauline sense, but then they enter the world of the gospel, take on its demands, practice its lifestyles, and so on, that they become living demonstrations along with us, we trust, you know, of all that the gospel means so it can be seen. So I do agree with you. There's a sort of panicked reaction which tumbles over into the tendency to seek to foist. And you can see it in the book burning horrors in America. Although actually some of the so-called liberals are just as much censorious as the other side. But that's beside the point. I thoroughly agree with you on the foisting. But there's a slight confusion also in what you said, though. Because America is not post-Christian in the sense that Britain or Australia are.
No,
I mean, fair enough. In other words, the extraordinary thing that although they have the size and numbers and so on they have, American Christians are talking about it, some of them as if there are about three of them left. You know, I don't know them personally, but I've heard millionaires in California, Southern California, who have built caverns in the Mexican mountains, diverting waterfalls, etc., because they're preparing for the huge collapse coming, where they can keep their families and their communities intact. And that Christian version of survivalism and the quoting of the end of the world and the second coming all together in a kind of huge rationale for escapism is abominable. At the time, there are so many of them as salt and light, not being very salt or very light where it counts. As I quoted that Anabaptist person last night who said his vision for America was that the Russians would come in the next 10 years, and through the purging of the church, there'd be a rediscovery of purity. Well, both of those, on the left and the right of the sort of Christian spectrum, I think are signs of a failure of nerve of faith. Because America, unlike Britain, isn't post-Christian in that sense. She's not Christian in the sense because there's no state church running. But the Christian community is an enormous size if they were sensitively, you know, in every area, the arts as well as economics, as well as justice, as well as law, you know, really to be responsible, they could make an enormous creative contribution in 10, 15, 20 years to the world. I have a friend at Oxford who's an economist who is an academically tough, hard-nosed economist, but I've seen him in public getting really passionate about one belief he has. And that's it, the 20th century equivalent of Wilberforce's stand against slavery, which, after all, has been no greater stand than a moral overturning by a bunch of individuals in history than that. The 20th century equivalent is the search for justice in the economic order internationally. He doesn't mean just a socialist redistribution, but a genuine search for justice. Now, if Americans were to throw their weight behind that, that would be the single greatest contribution to it. And yet, of course, most Christians aren't even interested in the problem. Yesterday I was quite careful to try and say, for a particular reason, that secularization was the neutralization of religion in the central sectors of society. And the reason I said that was, for those of you in the academic world, you realize why I did. As the thesis was originally stated, people got the impression that the whole of society was increasingly being secularized, therefore secularization meant the disappearance of all religion. And that is a myth, which was propounded by people who are basically secularists, who mixed in their own assumptions and were delighted to see what was happening in the centers and thought it was happening everywhere. Many Christians, for instance, Harvey Cox's Secular City, were mesmerized by this and applauded it in Christian terms, and it's extremely foolish. The central sectors of our societies have been neutralized. But in many ways, what's happened is the fringes haven't, and our societies are not so much post-Christian in the secular sense. They are post-Christian in a pre-Christian pagan sense. So in Australia, you can look for your own types of new religious aspirations. In Britain, we have what's called common religion. You know, irrational, fatalistic, semi-superstitious, all this thing sprouting on all sorts of levels. And these are just a couple of examples. You can see all around the world all sorts of new religious movements as well as secularization in the center. So thank you. It's always important to recognize the particular religious aspirations and dimensions, sometimes to be attacked, sometimes to be exploited for the gospel's sake in pointing people deeper and higher. You know, it's important to recognize these, and these don't clash against secularization carefully understood. Thank you. Yeah.
Could you comment on the peace movement?
I'm just trying to think of the name of an excellent book. Slipped from my mind. Here's an example. Let's leave aside absolutely the issue of bomb or no bomb. here's a good example in terms of what I was saying yesterday, of being self-critical about the context in which we come. Because, for instance, an awful lot has been done in the peace movement. I wish I could remember the name of the book, which has some of this in, sort of pro and con, studies of the peace movement. But one of the things is simply to... No, it's not a Christian book. Yeah, it's not that one. It's an excellent book. It's got a superb article by Vladimir Bukovsky, you know, on the Russians in the peace movement, and then it's got some other interesting articles on it. But one of the points is simply, for instance, did I raise this in discussion yesterday? I can't remember. But think of just the bias given the peace movement by privatization, in terms of what we were saying yesterday. Privatization, as we were analyzing yesterday, simply leaves the implication in this area. None of us lives for anyone else, virtually, in our private lives than ourselves. Everything encourages us to look after number one today. So this is not an age when we either serve others naturally, nor live and die for others naturally. In other words, privatization puts a heavy spin on the ball, which as it comes into the peace movement is one of the vitiating factors which could lead to a kind of Munich situation again. In other words, of the peace, don't misunderstand me, those of you who are in favor of the peace movement, please don't. Along with genuine convictions, and I'm not challenging those at all, please don't misunderstand me. Along with genuine convictions is a whole admixture of other impulses, psychological and sociological, and among others, here's this privatization coming in. So there are a lot of people who have incredibly unrealistic views about the world, reality, human nature. Put the spin of the ball of privatization, and you have something leading towards, actually, towards the mentality of 1930s appeasement building up. And that's why it's important to be self-critical historically and sociologically. Because the plain fact is, in the 30s, look at America. Most Christians in America were pacifists before World War II. Some of them actually shot out of pacifism into uncritical sort of militarism because they were so uncritical of the previous extreme before, which they abandoned with improper haste. The same happened in Europe. There was a terrific fear of aerial bombardment. It wasn't the bomb, of course, but the equivalent was aerial bombardment. A terrific fear. And that led to a terrific hunger for peace, which is quite unrealistic. Now, many analysts of the movement, again, through careful research as to why people are in it and what are their hopes and so on, point out the impact of privatization on the peace movement could give a heavy spin towards appeasement. In other words, that for the Christian would be very wrong. We are peacemakers, but we are not appeasers. And appeasement would lead actually to a worse injustice. Now, it's easy to see, we all know the problem on the other side. You know, then you mentioned the Festival of Light. That sort of person who is, I mean, not every Festival of Light person, but the same person who in his uptight defensiveness, psychologically and culturally, would do the foisting, equally would swing off and uncritically, let's keep the bomb, for those sort of reasons, rather than a carefully argued, you know, carefully Christian concern for defense with justice, and so on. In each case, we need to examine our own motivation and character and the cultural spin of the ball, to see where we're likely to be pulled off course. Yeah.
About 3 questions ago, you talked about the difference between foisting on society and Christian beliefs and a creative and constructive contribution to society. Can you explain this a bit better?
The early church won the Roman world. But they never foisted it on anyone until they'd won it, after which they went wrong when they started foisting it. You know, but up until that time, you just think of it, they just, you know, put it crudely, they did their thing in a wider and wider and wider and clearer, stronger way. In other words, if you're the only Christian, the impact of Christian faith in Australia is pretty small. But look, how many in the room? If you all do the Christian thing with consistency and clarity and courage, well, there's that much more. But then you take all the millions and so on who do. In other words, you've got the chance to practice and demonstrate any number of things. Now, I was talking to artists this morning, came up afterwards. They were discouraged. They're lost in the woodwork, small and stifled by the churches and so on. Well, we have in London an arts centre group, just 10 years old this year, now 700 professionals making their living in the arts by being Christian professionals, scriptwriters, poets, ballet dancers, television directors and so on. Now there's a whole structure to encourage them, support them, And you can actually say, look, go and see that. You can say, look at that film, or come to the pub here, we're discussing this. Non-Christian artists are intrigued by the philosophy, impressed by the films. You can see something. Christians haven't foisted anything. They've just practiced their Christian principles creatively, constructively, infiltratingly in the BBC and other places, and you can see the effect slowly coming. Now, I used the example of American attorneys yesterday. That's what the Zadok Center, I hope you all take the information on the Zadok Center. It's an attempt to have a Christian think tank, as it were, in Canberra that harnesses Christian minds, brings to bear biblical principles on Australian issues, you know, and so on. Well, you should be supporting it, feeding it, being stimulated by it, and so on. So it serves you, and you are encouraged by it. In 100 such ways, we are demonstrating the gospel, and that becomes its penetrating power. But we're not foisting it on anyone. It's the same as in evangelism. We win them not just by browbeating them, but by the power of love and the persuasiveness and clarity of our words, etc. And they see how Christians love each other. By this so all men know. And so on.
Are you suggesting then that legislation is always foisting?
Is always what?
No,
of course not. I mean, it'd be ridiculous at a certain point. You know, if a, you know, whatever the proportion is, we're Christian, and even the law of the land didn't reflect it. But you have to be very, very careful. In other words, we can clearly see all the dangers now from the past. We need to learn from those. Do you see the American problem, though? You see, when they separated church and state, they could do that because they could assume Protestantism, plus a bit of the Enlightenment, too. It wasn't just Protestantism. But the original assumptions aren't there. So the original assumptions were pluralist. They were safeguarding Protestant denominations, in effect. Now, in a secular climate, church-state separation means the antiseptic cleansing of religion from the centre. So what Australian Christians have done in 200 years by mistake is, as it were, bound their hands behind their backs. And now, by law, they cannot even apply their faith. Even if you were 100% Christian in America, which is unlikely, they couldn't even then. In other words, their actual system is out of kilter and is probably unworkable. David.
I was giving you all on the fantastic thing. There's a lot to say about the voice of the East, young people, drugs and so on, that appear to be achieving in short change. I don't know exactly where you wrote that, but I know it more than 7 or 8 years ago. What's your view on this now? Is it changeable?
I think there have been very significant changes. But the broadest one is simply, in those early days, there was a sense that of one, hope, and two, philosophical integrity in the searches. For instance, people took to LSD not to escape or for peer pressures, as, say, so many people just use cocaine today. But they genuinely had sort of mind-expanding goals in it, which they thought could liberate even mankind. Some of it looks remarkably utopian and romantic now. But there was extraordinary optimism and considerable philosophic and hopefulness in the way they did it, and that has all gone. You know, with few tiny segments left, most of the drug taking now is much more to do with where people are socially or in their peer pressure groups and so on. There's no real sense of the philosophical sense of what they're doing or of any optimism about what it might do to society. So drug taking in many ways has increased enormously and become a greater problem. But the type of drugs have changed and the whole mood in which they're taken has changed. The Eastern religion, I think, have grown marginally, but not very much. And while the press tend to play them up as compared to the church, you know, still significantly, we overshadow them enormously, just in the sheer facts of how many there are who are Christians and what are actually done, and so on. So I don't perceive them as a threat. I see them very much as one of the examples of the privately engaging, socially irrelevant type of thing in our society. Well, a person has since become a good friend of mine tells a marvelous story. I'll finish with this. Shows you what I mean. He said he was traveling on an airline in the States with someone who was wearing the full countercultural regalia, as he described it. You know, sort of the late 70s version of the old hippie. And this fellow sat down next to him and started recommending everything from free sex to drugs and all sorts of things, you know, the liberated lifestyle in that area. And this friend happened to be a pretty astute social scientist and knew the whole scene rather well. So he thought he'd play a game. He said, "Do you know, I'm very interested in that. And also, you've chosen the right airline. This airline really practices and operates on these principles. I mean, you probably know that they take grass up in the cockpit, and the stewardesses often, you know, take time off to make love, and they describe, you know, sort of a groovy, swinging, liberated airline. And he built up the story cleverly and slowly. He said, after 20 minutes, this fellow next to him was sitting there in a state of barely controlled panic. In other words, this was fantastic stuff for his personal life, but you couldn't run the airline on that. You know, and in a way, that's where many of these sort of things are now. In terms of a free, secular, liberated society, they're great for a groovy lifestyle in the home world. Then they go to work, business suit, etc., and they're comparatively square people, many of them. You know, but it's like much Christian faith, privately engaging is socially irrelevant. And the challenge of the gospel, you know, is consistent to the whole of life.
Perhaps you sort of touched on this as you've gone on with the social scene that we've got, because, you know, with different generations, you've got the sort of pre-60s, and you've got people who have a Christian morality without Christ. And then when you deal with people perhaps in the 60s, you can really deal with them in facts. You know, you can argue with them, you can present claims of Christ, and, you know, this whole creation evolution type approach. When you're getting into the 70s, and the kids who are coming through now, they're not so interested in facts. There aren't really any facts. It's all relative, and one religion is as good as another. And if this works for you, that's great. What comment would you have on evangelical approaches to the up-and-coming generation that we have at the moment?
Yeah, no, excellent question. That's what I was talking on this morning. For those of you who are there, it's a superb description of the problem I was addressing. The plain fact is, I would say, put simply, that 99% of our communication is addressed to the 1% open, interested, and needy enough to understand what we're saying. Whereas 99% are either militantly against or the great bulk complacent and so bemused by relativism and secularism, they can't make sense of it, even if they're interested enough. In other words, most of our techniques are that, techniques, and far too limited. Whereas I think biblical communication, there was a respect for truth and for people which gave both freedom and flexibility. You could speak to people wherever they were. So, biblically, at one end of the extreme is the Ethiopian, Philippian jailer, you know. He's hanging all over the place. What must I do to be saved? But you don't meet many like that. But when you have them there in the scriptures, or today, a druggie or someone like that, clearly you can be as simple and straightforward as Paul was. No beating around the bush, nothing. Just right in. But most people aren't there. What you see in scriptures is that as you move from one end of the spectrum, which is total openness and need, to the other end, which is almost complete closure and no sense of need, the biblical communicators, from the Lord himself downwards, use an approach that is flexible and specific to people, but the more closed people are and relativistic their understanding and resistant their hearts, the more indirect and subversive the communication is. So the mildest form is they shift from prose statements to questions. You look in Scripture when, for instance, Adam and Eve, how does God speak to them? Not a series of statements, you've done wrong, a series of questions. How's Job answered when his doubt forces him to blasphemy? More than 50 questions in a row. How does Jesus deal with questioners who are serious? Straight answers. Questioners who are not? Counter questions. It's just that's the trivial example. You move up to profound examples in the parables and the ploys, and what you see is that the less open a person is, the more the whole framework of their hearts and minds have to be subverted. Biblical word is simply repentance, an overturning and change of heart and mind, which is the prerequisite for conversion. But the more you see also that the styles and structures of the very communication also mirror the overturning. Do you see what I mean?
Yes. Now, what you're talking about, of course, is very much a one-to-one situation, isn't it? That's, you know, where you're dealing with,
which is always where most people are one. No, as with all tools, if they have their own integrity, any tool is limited. You don't use a screwdriver for a chisel. Now, built into the assumptions of mass evangelism is you have, say, 45 minutes. Now, even there, when Moody preached for 45 minutes, he could assume X years of Christian background, so his 45 minutes was kind of like a nail knocked home, but they had an awful lot more. With Billy Graham in many of our big cities in, say, Britain, as compared to the south of the United States, and the south, of course, is where Britain was 100 years ago in some ways, spiritually speaking, he can assume virtually nothing. So they know very little more than he gives them in that 45 minutes, which means the content and the width of the appeal is very much less reduced in terms of those who were there, his approach. So it has its integrity, but like any tool, one must see what it's most good at, but where it's useless too. And any attempt at mass evangelism, because it's mass, will reach the masses, is quite wrong. It reaches those who are open and interested and needy. It doesn't touch the outsiders. You know, studies still show that most people are won to Christ by their friends. Because there's a one-to-one specificness about that, which mass evangelism or electronic evangelism, these things, don't have. I don't so much want to comment on the film Gandhi as what Christians made of it. Because in a way, that was the interesting thing. What it showed us about the culture and the Christian culture rather than about Gandhi himself. Because all films, you know, so on, have their own particular treatment. I mean, most of us love Chariots of Fire. Chariots of Fire distorted the history quite cheerfully for its own purposes. You know. And so, the film Gandhi did too. You know, but that's almost inevitable in that. So let me leave aside Richard Attenborough's purposes and so on. To me, the interesting thing was the sort of Christian comments on Gandhi. I read a whole number of, I didn't read any Australian ones, incidentally, but of English and American critiques of Gandhi. And by and large, compared with non-Christian critiques, they were remarkably uncritical and adulatory in a naive way. Now, a lot of you are readers, you said, of Sojourners. Let me be thoroughly specific here. Sojourners had the most appallingly naive commentary on the film Gandhi, ending up with the words, "Gandhi shows us the way out of hell." So you had the most extraordinarily naive canonization of Gandhi by a Christian writer, mixed in with some extraordinarily unbiblical theological nonsense at the end. Now, many of them were less extreme than that, but there was some appalling naivety. Interestingly, it took some of the secular critics to look at the best and worst of the film. The best and worst of Gandhi, the best and worst of Attenborough. So you may have seen the review which Richard Grenier did in Commentary magazine. It was a long review and put most of the Christian reviews absolutely to shame, examining the cultural context in which Gandhi was being viewed, the person, what was shown, what wasn't shown, what was being picked up, what was ignored. It made most Christian reviews look really sloppy. And what it showed about America is that in the 1950s, since most conservatives were in the closet, they would have viewed the film with suspicion and been hypercritical, probably dismissive. Now that they're out there in the mainstream establishment, you know, they were talking about what Gandhi shows us of Christ and all we have to learn and Gandhi saves us from hell and this sort of stuff. Appallingly unbiblical naivety. Partly just because of their cultural respectability. He had dulled many of their sensibilities and their critical faculties. So it showed an awful lot about where the Christian culture was, quite apart from whether or not it portrayed Gandhi himself accurately. Oh, this will be the last and we'll stop for a good break. Have some Christian what? Tremendous. I've got the address of one of them. No, I don't actually. No, someone else gave me their address. Well, if any of you are in that, he who has ears to hear. Let him hear. Okay, now what we'll do is have a break till 3:30. And there's tea downstairs, provided courtesy of the college, for which we thank you. Coffee downstairs. And we'll start again.